Thank you for the invitation. And as you said, climate refugees is a very a topic everybody's talking about. And I wrote a book on climate refugees that came out 3 years ago. And I started by going to three different countries, to Pakistan, to Egypt, and to Kenya, just to see if there would be any climate refugees. And because I thought climate refugees is something that maybe my children or my grandchildren will see. But as we've seen now, and as a lot of people coming from Syria, we can see that climate refugees is a fact today in our world. So I just wanted to give you a small picture of how a climate refugee can look like or who it is. So here is Pakistan. And I went to different parts of the country after the big floods in 2010, when 1/5 of the country was underwater and 20 million people fled. So we're just going to go to the Swat Valley. Maybe a lot of people think about the Taliban when you say Swat Valley. And yes, they were very active there. And that is where I met Aisha. It looked like this. I came to a small village in the Swat Valley, and people had started to build up their homes again. So they fled 2 kilometers up to the mountain, and they used to live in tents, and then they started to build up their houses. So here's what a house could look like. So you have an outdoor place where they have their woods and stuff, and then you have one room for a whole family. And a lot of women there, they were too scared to talk to me, but Aisha, she wanted to tell me what happened that day when the floods came. And what Aisha told me that was interesting, that she and her family had fled their home several times because of the fighting between the Taliban and the Pakistan military, but this time they had to flee forever because the house that they used to live in and that they built up, it didn't exist anymore. And Aisha, she was around 30, and she was a seamstress. Now her brother that she used to live with and his family, he went around different cities to try to find work day by day to save up money to maybe be able to build a house again. And I said, so if you have saved up money, can you build a house where you used to live? And she said, no, because the land that the house were on, it's gone. And I couldn't understand, what did she mean by the land is gone? So we actually went to the village. Sorry, I have to do like this so I can see the clock. So we actually went to the village where she came from, and she pointed out over there by the trees was where her house used to be at. And this is the Swat River, and when the floods came, it took everything with it, not only land, but also houses and belongings to people. And this is called the landslide. So when we look back into the village, it looked like this. So what happened in Pakistan was that this year, 2010, and the following year also 2011, the monsoon rains were much more than usual. And monsoon rains is something people actually need to survive. They have their lives according to monsoon rain. But when we have warmer temperatures in the atmosphere, then we have warmer seas. And when we have warmer seas, then the vapor is much more. So for every degree that is warmer in the atmosphere, we have 7% more vapor in the air. So when we have more vapor, then we have more clouds, and then we have heavier rains. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into this specifically, but that is the big picture. So 2010 was the year that 1/5 of Pakistan were underwater. 20 million people fled, most of them within the region within even the small region. Like, for example, Aisha, she left for maybe 2-3 kilometers, but she couldn't go back home to her own village. But 2010 was also one of the most extreme years and one of the warmest years on record until now. So you can say Aisha is a climate refugee. Then I went to Kenya, and during the summer of 2011, one of the worst droughts in 60 years hit the whole Horn of Africa, and a lot of people from Somalia and Ethiopia walked actually into Kenya and to the different slums around Nairobi. So there I met some people. So this is what it can look like in a slum area. Here's garbage from a place close by this slum where rich people live, and they don't want their garbage, so they put them here in the slum. So it's very not so fancy houses, as you can see. And there I met Fatuma, and she used to be from a village here in Mandera, very close to Somalia and Ethiopia. And she was a pastoralist. She and her husband, they had some animals and livestock that they lived on. And they felt during this last drought that this was the worst drought ever, because the rain patterns that we have here in Horn of Africa is that you have the short rains in December, January, and then you have a drought, and then you have the long rains maybe between May and July, August, and then you have drought again. So this is also a circle and cycle that people, especially pastoralists, know, and they know how to handle it, and they know that, okay, maybe if one rain doesn't come or two, we still know how to find water and so on. But what the problem was for Fatuma and many other people during 2011 drought is that it hadn't rained between 3 and 5 years in a lot of in a lot of places in Horn of Africa. So for 5 years, Fatuma didn't see good rains here in Mandera. So when this last drought came and almost all their livestock died, she and her husband felt that no, we cannot live here anymore. She didn't want her children to starve. So they moved to this slum area called Korogocho outside Nairobi. And this is how she lived now, in a small room. And she felt that home was much better. There she had her mother and her sisters and people that could help out. She felt alone here. Here they had to pay for rent, they had to pay for water, which they didn't have to do in their village. But then when the drought came, she and her sisters and mother had to go even further to get water. So it was very double for her. She longed home, but she also thought that here my husband can work and our children can at least eat some meals every day. So these are just two examples of who is a climate refugee today. But how can you say that these people are climate refugees? How didn't they just flee because they were poor? And usually I use a picture of a wounded soldier, because the word in English, vulnerability, it comes from the Latin vulnerabilis, and vulnerabilis was what the Romans called a wounded soldier. So when you have a wounded soldier and you have an unwounded soldier and an attack comes, the one that will make it most probably is the non-wounded soldier. And that's exactly what's happening to our planet. We have a planet where we have extreme weathers coming more and more often, and there are already some people that are wounded because they live in the global south, because they are poor, because they are women, or because they are old, or because they are sick. So all these different components make them wounded when a big extreme weather event comes, for example, a drought or a flood. So if we look at some statistic, 70% of all the people that live below the poverty line are women. So it means that they are much more vulnerable to this sort of events. Or the people that you met, Aisha and Fatuma, they are directly dependent on what the land can give. They are farmers or they are pastoralists. So, for example, during 2010, there was a big drought also in Russia, and the price of wheat went up. We here, I suppose I cannot see you, but we can still have this buffer that we can pay some more kroners or euros and get the flour, but a bit more expensive. But people that are directly dependent on what the land or the sea gives them, they feel these changes in climate so, so much more than we do. So, and they are much more vulnerable. So when Fatuma and her husband lost all their livestock, they had nothing left. So they had to move. They had to go to Nairobi. They had to migrate. And what we are seeing today with the big refugee crisis in Syria, not a lot of people wanted to talk about this some years ago, but between 2006 and 2011 was the worst drought in many, many, many years in Syria. And actually, 2009, the American embassy in Damascus wrote to the White House, and this was leaked with the WikiLeaks document, saying that there is a really big drought in Al Jazeera region, and we are warning for this because a lot of people are moving into the cities. And actually, just before the start of the Syrian revolution, 2011, 1.5 million farmers couldn't live on their land anymore and had to move into the cities. And that puts a lot of pressure on the society, of course. So climate change definitely has made a big contribution to the conflict that we see in Syria and to the big refugee crisis that we see. So amongst people that are coming here now, or even people that are, millions of people that are living in refugee camps in Turkey or in Lebanon or in Jordan, a lot of them are actually climate refugees today. But the thing is that according to international law, we don't have a definition of climate refugees. If you are going to be a refugee today, you have to talk about the Geneva Convention from 1951. So it's very old, and it says that you are a refugee if you're barred from returning to your home country due to fear of persecution on the grounds of ethnicity, religion, nationality or political beliefs. So it doesn't have to do anything with climate. But within academia, there are a lot of researchers talking about climate refugees and that how important it is to have a definition. Because if we don't have a legal definition of climate refugees, then they don't have any rights. And one of the best definitions that I found when I was working on my book was from Frank Biermann and Ingrid Boas, and they are migration researchers. And their definition is that climate refugees are people who have to leave their habitats immediately or in the near future because of sudden or gradual alteration in their natural environmental related to at least one of three impacts of climate change: sea level rise, extreme weather events, and drought and water scarcity. Now, I didn't talk here about Egypt, but I also met a lot of farmers in Egypt that have the problem with sea level rise, and where the next generation is not able to live on that land. So this definition makes also people that aren't crossing borders refugees, because today you are a refugee only if you cross a border. But as a lot of research tells us, is that when you flee, you most probably flee within your country. You flee very, very close to home. One, because you don't have any resources. If you want to come from Syria to Sweden, you have to have a lot of resources. You have to have a lot of money. But also because a lot of people want to return back to where they came from. They have their networks, their jobs, their history, their roots, everything from where they had to flee. So people that are fleeing internally displaced people that the UN calls them, they are not refugees and they don't have the same rights. So, but no, I don't think that suddenly there will be this refugee revolution where the Western countries will open the border just if we have a legal definition. But if we have a legal definition, and this is why we don't have a legal definition until now, when we have a legal definition, then the Western countries or the rich nation, northern part of the globe, has to say that, yes, this is a debt that we have to you. We caused climate change, and we are going to give you your rights. Unfortunately, there is not much hope when it comes to the negotiations. Just a week ago, the recent draft that was written for Paris took away climate refugee part totally, because Australia is not going to accept any mentioning of climate refugee. And a lot of small island nations around New Zealand and Australia is actually asking Australia and New Zealand, can you open your countries for us when our countries are lying underwater? And both New Zealand and Australia said totally no, and we are not going to welcome you. And they are also the ones that are stopping all negotiations around the climate refugee issue. But if we are going to, I think the situation is very different from Sweden and Finland. Sweden took in a lot of refugees. I met a lot of refugees that are going to Finland because they heard that Finland is giving asylum much more than Sweden will do in the future. So there are all these rumors going around. But as a left movement that is working for refugees' rights, we also need to talk much, much more about climate refugees. Because when we talk about climate refugees, what the solution is to actually open our borders. That is one of the ways to pay back our debt to the global south. They didn't do anything to create climate change. Our countries did. So it is going to be challenging to adapt to climate change, but one way to adapt is to actually let people that want to come to safer ground to actually do it. So it's very important when we talk about adaptation to climate change and about actual humans that are going to be affected by climate change and the global warming, that they need protection and they have to come here. I'm going to be in Paris. Unfortunately, these issues are not going to be on the negotiating table. But I think that because of what's happening now, a lot of people are coming. There is a momentum to talk about refugees, and now also is the time to actually start talking about climate refugees. When my book was released in Sweden 3 years ago, nobody talked about climate refugees. Suddenly now, this year, this autumn, there is something called Musikhjälp and the Music Help. They make young people to contribute to some cause. And the cause this year will be climate refugees. So finally, people are start talking about climate refugees, at least here in Sweden. But the last thing I want to say, and how important it is, besides talking about climate refugees and actually pushing for open borders and non-militarized borders in Europe and in the US, is that we have to first and foremost work for stopping the emissions. Because if we stop the emissions, then we will actually not create more climate refugees. People won't have to leave their homes because of the effects of global warming. So there are those two things that we really have to work side by side. And I think I really like what Andreas was talking about. Climate jobs is so important, and that actually can kind of go hand in hand with talk about climate refugees. For a lot of parties in the West are saying, oh no, people cannot come and take our jobs and so on and so on and so forth. But if we actually have to create more jobs to try to put down the emissions, then we actually need people coming to help us do something about the Western economy.